Hey, hope you're enjoying the Grave Talks. Each and every week, we're now giving you two brand new episodes every Monday and Tuesday. Today and every Wednesday, we're going to flash back to some of our favorite interviews of the past. To listen to our complete archive of episodes, along with commercial-free advanced episodes of the show months before they're released to the public, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. It's only $5. You sign up now at patreon.com/thegravetalks or follow the links at thegravetalks.com. Today on The Grave Talks, return to Bothell. In a previous episode of The Grave Talks, we talked with Keith Linder about the haunting of his home. We discussed the chaos it caused in his personal life and the mental strain it took on him and his girlfriend at the time. His story was featured on an episode of Ghost Adventures. However, very little evidence was found by the Ghost Adventures crew, resulting in many calling Keith and his girlfriend a fraud. Despite the stories Keith shared and the existing evidence shown to a national audience, Keith endured ridicule and many expressing their doubt in his story. In 2012, Keith Linder and his girlfriend moved into what seemed like any other normal house in the Seattle suburb of Bothell. The phenomena they witnessed and fell victim to was truly horrific. Dark and overwhelming interactions with unexplained forces would change your lives forever and leave many in the paranormal community perplexed and questioning how such extremes could happen to one family alone. Today on The Grave Talks, we talk with Jenny Ashford about her book, House of Fire and Whispers, Investigating the Seattle Demon House. Jenny shares what happened with Keith after the Ghost Adventures episode and the compelling and shocking results of a more detailed investigation conducted by Steve Mara. Her story and accounts from Steve add a completely new layer to an already fascinating and amazing poltergeist case.
I had actually started out as a horror writer, like a horror fiction. Mm-hmm. And through my boyfriend, Tom Ross, he had experienced a very significant poltergeist phenomena when he was a boy back in the early 80s. And he had told me about it several times. And, you know, I'm kind of skeptical. And I was just kind of like, really? Did that really happen? And all this other stuff. But the more he told me about it, and I talked to his family members about it and stuff, and I was like, well, maybe there's something to this. So as the years went on, I was like, maybe we should write a book about it. It's such a great story, and I hadn't really read anything like that. So we wrote a book together about his experiences that was called The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. And then after, as we kind of got into talking about the book and doing promotional stuff for the book and things like that, he's like, you know, I'm kind of got more back into the whole poltergeist thing. I'm going to start looking for people online, parapsychologists and other people that have experienced it so that I can talk to them and maybe get a handle on what happened to me when I was a kid. And one of the people that he contacted, I believe he first contacted him on Facebook, was Steve Mara. And so they kind of struck up a friendship, and then I started talking to him, and he's a great guy. He's really interesting. He's really intelligent. And he actually read our book, The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, and he gave it a review and stuff. And he's like, you know, I have a bunch of cases that you might want to write about. I don't really have time to write them. And, you know, it might be something that we could do at some point. So as, you know, as time went on, we kind of started interviewing him about some of his cases. And then I wrote a book with him called The Rochdale Poltergeist. And then after that was finished and that came out, and he was kind of touring with that, and he said, oh, maybe we'll do another one at some point in the future. And then at that point, that was when Keith Linder had called him up and wanted him to come over from England to investigate his haunting. So after that whole thing happened in mid-2016, Steve was like, hey, do you want this to be our next project? I'll give you all the, you know, all of the SCP files and all of the thing, all of the data that I collect from it. And you can kind of put it into a book if you want to do that. So that's actually how I ended up writing a book with him about it. And I've actually only met Keith Linder once or twice, and it was over Skype. Mm-hmm. Most of the book was from Steve's investigation and, you know, what he experienced when he went there and everything that he was telling me about the impression that he got of the case. So I think that was kind of made it maybe kind of a more unique, you know, sort of angle on the book, because Keith has put out his own book recently, this just earlier this year, mm-hmm. about the haunting. But mine's actually, it kind of goes into a little bit about what happened to Keith before Steve Mara and Don Phillips, before they got there in early 2016. But most of it is through Steve's eyes. It's, you know, it's kind of from his point of view and everything that he collected and he experienced. So it's kind of like a different angle, coming at it from a different angle.
And that's why I wanted to have you on about it, because it's been a very fascinating thing. I talked to Keith the other week, and I had him on as a guest to hear his story. I am someone, when I do interviews, I do not do a ton of pre-educating myself on the actual haunting itself, because I want to hear it for the first time from the people I'm talking to. I want to just absorb it. I don't want to go into any sort of preconceived notions or judgments or anything of that nature. So I was completely unaware of, I guess, the controversy, for lack of a better term, that was surrounding his story. And I'm not here to say I believe, I don't believe, things of that nature. I take everybody at their word for their experiences. That's the point of what we do on the show. And I don't really watch Ghost Adventures or anything of that nature. But he brought it up in our interview about the experience that he had with them. So out of curiosity, I wanted to see what he was referring to and how he was presented on that program. Did you have a chance, because I'm curious about your perspective on it going in, did you see that episode of Ghost Adventures that he was featured on prior to getting into this with Steve for writing the book?
I actually watched it after I had interviewed Steve, mm-hmm. after all the interviews with Steve were complete and we were talking about it, because he had brought it up, because I mean the whole Ghost Adventures debacle, mm-hmm. was sort of the catalyst for Keith calling up, you know, Steve Mara and Don Phillips, like trying to get an actual real respected parapsychological team to come in and sort of vindicate him, because I think he felt like the show did him quite a disservice. Mm-hmm. And so while I was working on the book and Steve kept bringing it up, and I was like, well, I got to get a hold of this. So I got to see it, you know, before I write the book, just, you know, for my own edification. And so I went and watched it, and it really did seem as though it's odd, because I'm not a huge fan of these sort of paranormal TV shows. You know, they're for entertainment, obviously, and I will watch them in that vein. But I'm kind of more on the scientific, you know, parapsychological sort of tip, and I, you know, so I think these shows kind of do a disservice, because they make everything, they really just want to go in and they're like, we want to just want to capture stuff on camera. They're not really worried about you know, being really stringent scientifically or anything of that nature. So the strange thing to me was that the fact that they went in there and made kind of a big deal about not really finding anything, which to me seemed very strange. It seemed to me that you'd think they would play up, you know, anything they found, because it was a TV show. But the way that they sort of said, oh, well, they're faking, or particularly the way that they treated his girlfriend at the time, Tina, making her look like she was responsible, or at least implying that she was responsible. And so I could kind of see why Keith was angry, and I could see for sure why Tina was angry and why she ended up leaving after the show aired, because she ended up getting a lot of abuse, so I've heard, because they thought that somehow she had some kind of bad mojo or bad vibes or something that was attracting negative energy to the house or whatnot. So, you know, I can kind of see how that goes. And like I said, I'm not a big fan of Ghost Adventures. I have to say, I'm not going to be too explicit, but I've never really liked that show. They're good for entertainment purposes, but I think as far as the serious investigation of paranormal activity goes, I think it's generally probably doing more harm than good. And I think it really did in this case.
I would agree. It was one of those things where, I mean, I understand how television production works. I've been involved in it. You have to have your angle. You have to have your side of the story. And typically I feel that show goes over the top to make a case for something when maybe there isn't. And they did the exact opposite on that episode. Granted, there were many, just from a looking at this evidence-wise, questionable things. It did look as though things had been spray-painted on the walls.
Sure.
There was a lot of things that did kind of raise some eyebrows, and I from the perspective of going, if I was a skeptic, I'd be very skeptical about this. But then in talking to Keith, he seems extremely authentic. He seems extremely honest in what he's talking about, and very much affected by the case. So, I mean, it was really interesting, because I did this all within the course of 2 hours of having a very in-depth conversation with him, and then seeing that and going, wow, that's interesting. What I know you in the book, you talk about things kind of leading up here to the investigation where Steve came in. Does that pick up essentially what was going on with his world after the Ghost Adventures aired, and then into where Steve comes into the picture?
Yeah, that's definitely one. And like I said, you know, Keith was just looking, I think, for someone with some serious scientific credentials to back him up and say, you know, I'm not crazy, I'm not making this up, I'm not hoaxing, I promise. And so he ended up, he had read a book. I don't remember if it was the other book that I had written with Steve, or it might have been another one about another case that Steve had done. But he actually ended up contacting Steve and his, you know, parapsychological establishment in England, in Manchester, and asking for help. Now, at first, and Steve was very adamant in, you know, detailing his whole process to this to me. He's like, you know, at first I get these emails from him, and he's sending me, you know, links to his YouTube channel where he's documented, because he was very stringent in, you know, videotaping everything that happened. He had security cameras all over his house. He had audio recorders going and things of that nature. So, and he had a YouTube channel where he would put up, you know, 7-8 hour videos, you know, that just had like a little bit of banging on it, like 4 hours in or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So Steve was like, so I kept getting these emails, and I kept getting these emails, and he's like, finally, you know, I figured, well, okay, he's not going to go away, so I have to keep, so, you know, I'm going to look into this and see if there's anything worth looking at. And one of the videos that he looked at, he said that kind of changed his mind. He's like, 'cause I saw one on YouTube that was 7 hours long, and it was just basically a video of an empty hallway. It was one that he had just filmed while he was at work one day, and it just was filmed the hallway. And he's just like, there's nothing happened for 4 hours. And then about 4 hours in, there was like this weird banging. And he's like, you know, if someone was going to go to all the trouble to fake this, you'd think that they would have made the video shorter. They would have faked something that showed up on camera rather than just a strange, like, audio anomaly that could have been any one of many other things. So he said, so maybe there's something to this. So he started talking to Keith, you know, emailing him back and forth, and he talked to him on Skype a couple of times. And as he researched the case, and he told me this, you know, very in no uncertain terms, he's like, when I investigated the case and looked into it and was thinking about going to investigate it, he's like, I noticed that Ghost Adventures had been there. Several other psychic teams and local paranormal investigators had been there. It had been in the media quite a bit, and a lot of the attention surrounding it was very negative. He said, so he's like, 9 times out of 10 in a case like this, we would not investigate it because there was just too much baggage. We wouldn't be able to approach it with the objectivity that we like to approach it with. But he said, you know, the more I talked to Keith and the more I looked into his case and stuff, he's like, I felt that he was very sincere, and I felt that he sincerely needed our help. And he's like, so that was kind of the thing that decided him to actually kind of, because it was a big deal for them. I mean, they had to go all the way to Seattle from Manchester. It was very expensive. They don't usually do a lot of investigations out of England. So he's like, it was kind of a big deal for us to take it on because it had been such a controversial case. And he's like, and we don't usually like to get involved in that type of thing because we can't approach it with any objectivity.
Sure. And I understand it'd be a big deal to do that, like you just said. What was, and I guess this is just if you know the answer to it, what was Keith's reasoning, and I didn't get a chance to ask him this, for continuing to I guess seek out help for this? It was a rental that he eventually did move out of, But what was, why was he continuing to seek this out, I guess, and try and get people to investigate, try and find answers after it had already done so much damage to his relationship, to reputation, with people judging? Why did he want to keep going with it?
Yeah, I kind of wonder about that myself. It's like, I don't really want to speak for him necessarily, but mm-hmm. I almost feel like if I had been in the same situation, I might have done the same thing, because I feel like I have a very curious personality, and I also have kind of a stubborn personality. So if something was going on in my house and I couldn't figure out what it was, and I had spent all this money trying to figure out what was going on, and I'd had all these people in trying to figure out what was going on, I mean, even if, you know, bad things had happened, because like you said, his girlfriend ended up leaving him, and, you know, eventually he ended up getting kind of a lot of negative publicity and being called a hoaxer and things like that. But in some ways, I think it almost gets a hold of you. I think he got a little bit, I don't necessarily want to use the word obsessed because it sounds negative, but you know, I don't really see it in a negative way at all. I mean, it's such an amazing thing that happens. Like, I've had, you know, minor poltergeist activity happen, but even that is like really fascinating. And I've heard from, you know, my boyfriend Tom, who had a very significant poltergeist thing happen to him when he was a kid. He's like, it's just, it's scary, but it's fascinating. It's something that you, it's amazing. It's something you don't experience every day. And he's like, you just want to get to the bottom of it. What is causing this? How is it happening? Why is it doing this? And I kind of feel like that might have happened in Keith's case. Now, he did eventually, it did eventually get to a point where he started to feel threatened, at which point he moved out. But prior to that, I mean, he lived there for 4 years. And despite all the, you know, sort of minor destruction around his home, which he did have to pay to get fixed and things of that nature, I don't feel like he felt as though he was personally or physically threatened at any point until later on, at which point he said, okay, well, I better move out. And I think it even before they moved out, because Steve Mara and Don Phillips actually investigated his house 2 times. They went for 6 days in January of 2016, and then they went again for 8 days along with Nick Kyle from the Scottish parapsychological investigation team. And they were there for 8 days in April of 2016. And so Keith moved out shortly after that, but they even advised him, you know, your interest in this is probably making it continue, and perhaps you should stop doing it. So he might have taken that under advisement as well. But, you know, I can see why you would be curious about it. I would be curious about it, and I would probably behave in much the same fashion.
Especially when you have something that is legitimately going on, when you are living through something that is that stressful and that trying on you, and then almost built up to thinking, okay, great, now the world is going to hear my story. Now they're going to understand what's going on. And then for it to be that big of a letdown where literally nothing happens and they're not able to document anything or show anything. And in fact, the exact opposite is what is presented to the world. But then they leave and you go back to that torment and the strange things that are going on, the unexplained things that are going on. It's almost, it's a quest, you know, to be, have your name revived, to have, to be, what word am I looking for here? You know, some justification to the case. And so I get it. I get that drive. I just wanted to get a better understanding of where you understood he may be at after all that, because we touched on in the previous interview pretty much up into right after the ghost adventures had happened and when the relationship ended. And that's kind of where we ended the conversation. So once Steve gets over there and begins to take a look at things, what's going through his mind? What is he experiencing? What is he finding? And like I said, what's going through his mind is my big question initially.
The interesting thing about it is that, I mean, when Steve and Don came to the U.S. to investigate this case, Steve had actually never been to the United States before, so it was kind of a big thing for him. And I kind of put a little bit of that in the book because I thought it was kind of neat the way he was kind of all the things he was amazed by in the United States and stuff. But I mean, obviously, he thought that there was something to it, or he wouldn't have come. But I mean, Steve and I know him. I mean, I've spoken to him many times. over Skype and over the phone and things, and we've done several shows and written a couple books together. He is a very, very skeptical person. He's open-minded, but if there is a rational explanation for something, he's going to go with that. He's not, you know, he's not jumping to paranormal. Even if it's something that could have been paranormal or he can't explain it, he's like, well, I'm just putting that down as an unknown. So when he first arrived, I think he was still a little bit ambivalent about, you know, is this really something that's going on? I would have hate to have come all this way and it was just a hoax or nothing happened. I don't think that he expected it to be that way because he had seen a lot of the videos and he had spoken to Keith. But it was a kind of a situation where the much larger events that Keith described prior to Steve and Don getting there, such as, you know, the Bibles catching fire, the trashing of the office, the writing on the walls, all that kind of thing. Now that seems to have diminished, evidently seems to have diminished significantly after the house had been blessed several times. I think he had a Native American shaman in there. I think he had an Episcopalian priest in there. So he had some things done, and the bigger ticket items, the furniture moving and stuff, that had substantially diminished, but there was still a lot of smaller things going on. And so when Steve got there, I think he was sort of open. He was very skeptical of the larger things. He's like, I don't think I'm going to see anything like that, but maybe we'll see some, you know, minor things or some things that are kind of significant. The interesting thing that happened, though, was that even though nothing, you know, really, I'm not going to say earth shattering, but, you know, they didn't see the offices being trashed, nothing caught fire or anything like that. But a lot of the things that they captured the first time they were there were actually very, very significant. And there was a lot more of it than Steve had ever previously encountered on any of his previous investigations. I mean, he said he was only there the first time they were there for 6 days. And they said they got so many, you know, some EVPs, they got object movement, they got all kind of like audio anomalies, they got all sorts of things like strange readings and stuff like that. And he said it was really, he had never experienced that volume of things happening in that brief of a time, just at one particular location, which is another reason why he was so skeptical of the Ghost Adventures team. He's like, you know, we were here. He's like, you know, they were here. I believe the Ghost Adventures team, like Zach and the other hosts, were there for 11 hours, but their team had been there off and on over a week. And they said they didn't capture anything, but Steve was like, we were there for 6 days and we captured, you know, over 400 EVPs, just tons of different strange, like, you know, cameras turning by themselves, balls moving by themselves, things of that nature. So he's like, I really don't understand why they didn't capture anything or chose to portray it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the bigger question, I think, in some of this is how was it, was nothing truly captured, or was this just the angle they wanted to go on the show?
Right.
And neither of us really know the true answer to that, but it's easy to have suspicions. I mean, does that ever occur with the investigations that he's been on or that you've heard of, where sometimes, I mean, I know sometimes things just won't happen, but that seemed to be such an active home with everything that Keith talked about in his story, to have investigators go in there with all the equipment that they did, to have literally nothing show up for one group, in a thorough investigation, not just a, hey, we're here for a couple hours, but they had been there for a good week and have nothing show up. And then another group comes in and then it makes itself known. Is that common in any way, shape, or form for nothing and then just boatloads?
Yeah, it seemed very strange. I mean, in general, from talking to Steve, and, you know, he's been a parapsychologist for 30, 35 years, and, you know, on most of his investigations, he's like, you know, we'll get things here and there, but it's not like, you know, you don't go in a house for 6-7 days and you get like tons and tons of data. It just doesn't usually happen. So he's like, that was another thing that was very unusual about this case, is that evidently, I mean, even though Ghost Adventures, yes, it's a TV show, but they do have some rudimentary equipment. They do have, you know, things, and they do have a vested interest in showing things happening. So he's like, he found it very strange that, you know, that they said that they hadn't captured. I believe the only thing, if I remember correctly, it's been a while since I saw the show, but I think the only thing they logged that was unusual was three of their cameras or three of their other pieces of equipment had been, the battery had been drained, you know, all of a sudden. So that was like the only thing they had captured. And so it just seems very weird. I don't know if it was just because their equipment wasn't as good. Maybe their protocol, like their scientific protocol, wasn't as good. You know, as you said, maybe they wanted the show to be, oh, we didn't find anything, or it's a hoax, just to make the show look like it was more skeptical. Maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm. If that was maybe the case. You know, we can't have them all look like, hey, ghost, hey, ghost, hey, demons, hey, ghost. You know, here's one that's like, we went there and investigated and it's not real, you know, so we're legitimate. Yeah. So it could have been a question of that also. But I mean, the fact that Steve and Don went there and were not expecting to find as much as they found, and, you know, finding pretty much more than they'd found on any other investigation they'd ever done. I mean, they just had mounds and mounds and mounds of data. Just a ridiculous amount. Like I said, mostly EVPs and various audio anomalies, but they got a lot of strange object motion and things like that too. So I'm not really sure why that is. But as I said, I think it's why this case is still so interesting, and why Steve Mara is still very interested. And Don Phillips is also, he just put out the his documentary about it. Also, that's on his website, of all the stuff that he and Steve filmed at the time. So I think that's kind of one of the reasons that this case is still so fascinating, is just because just like went from nothing to everything, like in the space of a few months, I guess.
What were some of the more significant things that were found on his investigation specifically?
One of the things that interested me very much, was the weird object movement. And they had a couple cases of this where Steve could not explain, you know, how this had happened. And the one of them, the first one that they experienced, I mean, the first thing they experienced was actually the door, the front door would open by itself, even when the deadbolt was still engaged. Like, they would all go out, they would lock the door, and Keith had an alarm system on his house that he had installed, and it actually talked. So when you locked the door, it would say door closed or front door open or whatever. And so he's like, you know, so we would leave and then we would come back, and then the front door would be wide open, but the deadbolt would still be sticking out. And when you checked the alarm system, it wouldn't have gone off, like, even though the door had opened when it was locked. So he said that happened on several occasions, and Keith was very blasé about it. He was like, yeah, that happens all the time. That's why I had the alarm system installed, you know. But one interesting thing that happened was that Keith had all these all the security cameras set up in his house, and they would ping him, and they would send him a picture from the camera. If the motion cameras were triggered, it would send him a picture to his email account. And they were all sitting in the house, because Steve and Don actually stayed in the house the entire time. So they were there pretty much 24/7. And they were all sitting in the dining room, and his email pings, and he opens it and he's like, oh, it was the camera that's in the living room that's pointing at the front door. And he said it just took a picture at, you know, about 7 minutes ago. So they open up the picture that the camera took, and he's like, well, it should be of the front room, because that's the camera that points, you know, toward the front door. So it should be a picture of the living room. And it wasn't a picture of the living room. It was a picture of a wall. So they were like, well, that's interesting. So they all, you know, as a body, they all go out into the living room, and they see that this camera has turned 180 degrees toward the wall, and now it's facing the wall. And this happened 7 minutes ago. All three of them were sitting in the dining room when this happened. All their backs were to it. And Steve notes, he's like, well, here's the thing. When that motion detector on that camera is triggered, it takes a picture that same second. He's like, so had this camera turned around, like, of its own volition, you would have got motion blur. But he's like, you didn't get that. You just had a picture of the wall, as if the camera had you know, somehow like teleported from one position to another position, like instantly before the camera had time to snap. Mm-hmm. So he's like, that was a very weird and mysterious thing that happened. And that was something he's like, there's no way somebody could have turned that around. We had all seen it. It was facing the door, you know, and it only happened a couple minutes before and no one had been in there. And so that was a pretty weird thing that happened. There was also another incident where Keith had actually, and I don't know if he mentioned this on the show, but he had had like a ceiling fixture in his upstairs hallway, and the upstairs hallway was kind of an area where there was it was very active. There was very a lot of activity in that area, and apparently the light in the fixture in the ceiling had been pulled out, and the like all the wires had been hanging out, and the shade had broken, and all this other stuff. So he had like all these little wall like mounted wall lights. And Steve, Don, and Keith were all downstairs again one particular night, and they all heard a very, very loud banging sound coming from the upstairs landing. So they all went up there, and one of the lights that had been mounted onto the wall was laying on the floor. And they were like, wow, well, that's interesting how that happened. So they put it back up on the wall, and they kind of banged on the wall and tried to get it. Did that just fall off or whatever? And they couldn't get it to fall off because it was on there with a hook and it was, you know, very well secured. And so then they said, well, what will happen if we just drop it by natural gravity? What kind of sound does it make? Because they had obviously recorded the audio of this occurring. So they started trying to drop it. And they said the interesting thing was that when they dropped it with normal gravity, they got a specific, you know, a little audio signature on their audiogram, their little spectrogram or whatever. And he's like, now the sound that it made when we first heard it, this very loud bang, he's like, the little peaks and valleys of the audiogram were exactly the same, but it was much, much louder. Now he's like, no, we went upstairs and then we tried to throw it at the ground to get it to make the same sound, but it didn't make the same sound. He's like, the audiogram looked completely different. He's like, so the weird thing was that had this just fallen off the wall, one, he's like, we wouldn't have heard it. It was only made of plastic. It wasn't really heavy. You know, I believe he said it was 3.8 decibels when it fell. He's like, and, you know, the sound we captured from it that was supposedly paranormally generated was more like 12 decibels. But he's like, we couldn't replicate the louder paranormal sound. He's like, well, if we just threw it at the ground, the audiogram would look completely different. But he's like, the creepy thing was that the two audiograms, the paranormal one and them just dropping it, looked exactly the same, except one was significantly louder than the other. And that's like a very common, that's a very common aspect of poltergeist cases where things make a sound that's much louder than it would have made naturally. And I'm not really sure why that is, but that's a very, very common occurrence.
It's almost as if they were like propelled to the ground. But even then, even throwing, sometimes it can't quite be replicated the same way. It's almost as if there's some other energy making an impact. That wraps up part one of our interview with Jenny Ashford about the return to Bothell. In part two of our interview with Jenny, we'll dig into the evidence found by Steve Mara and his team. We'll talk about the shocking EVP messages picked up and what they said. We'll also discuss the burning of Bibles, as well as the demonic messages and threats that turned up on the walls of this home. To listen to part two of our interview, become a Gravekeeper through Patreon. Visit our website at thegravetalks.com and click on the Become a Gravekeeper link, or directly through patreon.com/thegravetalks. That's patreon.com/thegravetalks. For $5 a month, you'll have access to every single part two bonus episode of our program, as well as access to all of our advanced episodes weeks and months before they are released. Your support is what keeps us on the air. Go to thegravetalks.com and click Become a Gravekeeper. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.